Thank you for joining us today on Modern Tech News on KZSU Stanford 90.1 FM. Today we have a very interesting interview with Stanford's president John Hennessy. The focus of the interview was to find out how Stanford University plans to deal with federal budget cuts to scientific research, and how Stanford could successfully lobby for more federal research funding, and also to find out whether Stanford had any plans to diversify its funding for scientific research. Before we begin the interview, here are some highlights about President John Hennessy. President Hennessy joined Stanford University in 1977 as an assistant professor of electrical engineering. In 1981, he helped invent a computer architecture known as RISC, R-I-S-C, which stands for Reduced Instruction Set Computer. The RISC architecture was revolutionary at the time because it improved performance while reducing costs. During his sabbatical in 1984, President John Hennessy founded a successful company called MIPS Computer Systems that commercialized his research in the RISC processors. In 1987, he became the Willard and Inez Kerr Bell Endowed Professor of Electrical Engineering and Computer Science. In 1999, he became provost and championed interdisciplinary activities in biosciences and bioengineering. In 2000, Stanford University's Board of Trustees voted President John Hennessy to become Stanford's 10th president. President John Hennessy has lectured and published many articles, and he wrote 2 textbooks on computer architecture and design. He won many awards, including the IEEE Medal of Honor, which he was awarded in 2012 for pioneering the RISC processor architecture and for his leadership in computer engineering and higher education. President John Hennessy's office is always open to students and to faculty. He is very well known in Silicon Valley, and some call him the godfather of Silicon Valley. We would like to thank President John Hennessy very much for this interview. We hope you enjoy today's show. Many of Stanford University's professors and Nobel laureates, including Professor Roger Kornberg, who won the Nobel Prize in Chemistry in 2006, have talked to President John Hennessy about what Stanford could do to keep its leadership in scientific research. As the federal budget cuts continue to shrink the funding for scientific research at Stanford and at all universities across America,
I think we face a serious problem. If you look, for example, at funding for the National Institutes of Health, which funds most of the biomedical research, and is actually the largest of the research agencies, federal research agencies. Since 2004, the funding, after adjusting for inflation, has gone down by about 1 to 1.5% a year. So that's now we're 8-9 years it's gone down. So that it's that compounding effect of going down year by year by year by year. And as that adds up, that coupled obviously with the sequester has led to serious questions about the U.S. commitment long-term to research and our ability to continue to fund it. So what do we do about this? I think the challenge lies in convincing the people in Congress that the federal investments in research are long-term investments in the country's future, in its young people, that are important to ensure that we're not only going to find solutions to critical problems, but that we're also going to have healthy economic growth in the future. Because, of course, many of the innovations that later on get used by companies come from that fundamental research. The difficulty Congress has is that it's got a set of entitlement programs that are growing much faster than inflation, that it's not able to, it seems unable to rein in. And so the result is this very small sliver of research, which is a tiny fraction of the overall federal budget, gets squeezed. Because in some ways, it's the easiest to squeeze. Really, the people who will benefit the most from that are children now. They're young people who will benefit in the future from today's investment. So I think the universities have rallied together and had a lot of discussions about how they address this problem. We need allies in that process. We need not only the universities to speak up and distinguished people like Roger Kornberg, Nobel laureates to speak up, but we also probably need corporate leaders to speak up and other leaders who will talk about the importance of the scientific research. And I think if we can get them to speak up, we can get Congress to perhaps focus a little more on not letting the research investment take the brunt of the need to tame the growth and the entitlement spending in the federal budget.
Stanford, MIT, and all the leading universities in America are very well connected in Congress. So why haven't they been able to convince Congress that continuing to spend on research is a good thing?
Well, I think two things have happened. First of all, the difficulty is that Congress has to move money or tame the growth of other programs, which of course also have various groups that support those programs. I mean, Medicare and Social Security obviously have a very strong support group in the senior citizen community and organizations like AARP, and perhaps even more voting power than a bunch of universities have. Therefore, I think the argument has to be made more along the lines of understanding the long-term impact. If you look at entitlement growth and you don't solve that problem, by 2050 or so, there'll be no research money left. Zero. There'll also be no money for highways, no money for roads, no money to help schools, no financial aid for students. There won't even be any defense spending left if you run that out a few more years because of the rapid growth of entitlement programs. And I think while that's a difficult problem, and it's a problem which if you begin to solve it today, you can solve it with minimal impact on people. But if you don't begin, if you just drive at this canyon, what you have to do to people's lives to solve the problem 20 years from now is much harder than what you have to do to make a little tweak now. That might not even affect anybody who retires for the next 5 or 10 years. But you begin to tweak it and reform the system so that you bend the curve and then we can do it. And I think that's what we have to get across.
Do most people in Congress understand what might happen by 2050 if the entitlement programs are not changed?
It's not that people in Congress don't understand this. They do understand it. It's just that it's very hard to take the steps that are necessary to bend that curve and make people understand the importance of it. You know, partly it's that Americans are very good in crisis. A crisis rallies them. They all rally around, whether it's a war, an event like 9/11. Look at what happened with the tornadoes or last year with Katrina. Americans rally around that. This will be a crisis 25 years from now. If we don't begin to solve it today, we'll have a crisis. And what we'll need to solve the crisis then will be a very bitter pill.
So what are some of the steps that could help solve some of these budget problems?
Well, I think some things have been done in the Affordable Health Care Act. There's been a few steps towards it. But we have to get better about controlling medical costs. We've got to get better about standardizing things and looking at pricing models, which say certain providers will be compensated in certain ways. Social Security is a great example, and it's probably the easier problem to solve. When Social Security was created, the retirement age was set to 65 because that was the life expectancy for males, 65. Now, males' life expectancy, people born in my year, it's 82. In my kids' year, it's 86 or 87. So now, instead of having a Social Security program where half the people never got anything because they were already dead at 65, and then you only had to deal with half the population, now we have a system where essentially 90% of the population makes it to 65, and half the population makes it to 85. So that's 20 years longer. We also have to think about the cost rises in Social Security. So Social Security is indexed. It's not indexed to the CPI, to a normalized CPI. It has a different index. As a result, it actually grows faster than inflation. There was a time when that was a good thing because it increased the amount of money going into Social Security. But now, it's increasing way too fast. For the lower income individuals who are getting Social Security, you could keep that index for the lower quartile or even the lower third. and then just dampen the index for most people so it didn't go up so fast. Those are the kinds of things we need to do and begin to get a grapple on. The danger, I think, to the research effort in the country, as well as, by the way, the federal investment in financial aid for students, Pell Grants and similar things, the danger is if you chip them away 1% a year and you just keep doing that for a long, long time, pretty soon you're dramatically underinvesting in the research capability of the country. And the U.S. will no longer have the best research capability in the country.
Are American universities planning to collectively work together to explain to Congress the importance of continuing to fund scientific research?
They are. They're working in Washington. We do a lot of work both as individual institutions, but also through the AAU, the Association of American Universities, which is the primary association that represents the research-intensive universities, the top 65, roughly, major research universities in the country. So we work together. There are also groups that represent the medical schools, for example, that are working in Washington to try to get this point to be understood. Again, we come back to an issue which is a key one in Washington. You're much better off if, when you're asking for more money, right, or to restore budgets, you're much better off if you have allies who are not direct beneficiaries, but who are long-term beneficiaries and understand the importance. So, for example, getting corporate leaders to go in and talk about the importance of university research for the long-term competitiveness and health of American industry. That's a really great argument because they care a lot about the long-term health and competitiveness of American industry. Because, of course, that's what drives the economy and eventually drives tax revenues and everything else. So having those kinds of allies in there is critical to really be successful in this discussion.
Has Stanford called on many of its corporate friends to help explain to Congress why it's important to keep spending on scientific research?
Yes, surely. I think we've looked for help from lots of companies, both here in the Valley. We've looked for help from the venture capital community, who funds many of the startups that come out of university research, as well as the large corporations, I think, whether it be an IBM or a Merck or somebody in a GE or a General Motors. So we look for allies among that whole group. And there are a number of different organizations that bring together universities and companies to talk about the importance of the long-term federal investment.
So is there a definite plan, or are all these corporate leaders going to talk to Washington for another couple of years before they have any concrete results?
We talk, we work, we try to ensure that our representatives in Congress are well informed about these issues and understand them. And I think in the end, the decisions have to be made by the leadership in the House and Senate. So we can inform the House, the Senate, the President, and try to get as many allies as possible. But that doesn't necessarily get you there and how you could get there. We are looking to other alternatives. I mean, beginning to think about other funding sources for university research and how much can we diversify it and not replace the federal government, because I think that's simply impossible. The size of the federal research investment here at Stanford, to replace it would be impossible. There's so much. It's a very large investment. On the other hand, can we bring in some other funding from companies or foundations, for example, that may supplement it in areas that are particularly under pressure and allow us to both diversify our funding sources as well as to keep them up in a time that's otherwise difficult?
Many of the leading art institutions in the country have stopped relying on federal funding many, many years ago. For example, the New York City Opera and the Metropolitan Opera rely on private funding for the most part.
They do. And of course, we rely also on many alumni that have supported our research, both direct supportive research in areas that alumni or friends of the university think are important, so we've done that, as well as gifts which, for example, of fellowships for graduate students who are then involved in research. These things all come to play. So over time, we've been able to diversify our funding sources some, but we're still, you know, the university's comprehensive budget still gets roughly a quarter of its money from the federal government.
Thank you for joining us today on KZSU Stanford 90.1 FM. Today, our guest is Stanford's president, John Hennessy. The focus of today's interview was to find out how Stanford plans to deal with the federal budget cuts to scientific research. I asked President Hennessy whether it's conceivable for some of Stanford's research departments and engineering departments to disappear, like its mining department disappeared when there was no longer any funding for mining research from the federal government.
Mining and some other areas went out of vogue, but there were some important differences. I think mining was not a technology that was undergoing incredibly rapid change anymore, the way, for example, the biomedical sector is, or information technology. Right now, they're just changing at an incredible rate, and there are still lots of fundamental issues and problems and just parts of nature that we don't understand. And understanding them better is likely to have a large long-term impact on the quality of our lives. So whether it's discovering fundamentally how cancer works and finding ways to address it, or it's investments in energy technology and trying to move to a greener future for energy. Those are all areas that are changing rapidly with high impact. Mining technology, which I think the federal government went out of decades ago, reached the point of fair amount of stability in the technology. It wasn't changing that rapidly. There was progress being made, but it certainly wasn't changing quickly. And it diminished in terms of its importance economically. In an earlier time, when the U.S. was a resource-based economy, then this was a very large fraction of the economy. Remember that if you go through the 1800s, the U.S. was still a largely an agricultural nation for much of the 1800s. And now agriculture is a very tiny sliver of our overall economy. And so the balance and how much research money you put into the field depends on both. How quickly is it changing? What's being discovered? How fast is the frontier moving? As well as what the potential impact of that work might be.
Are there any other engineering disciplines that were severely cut back because of reduced funding?
Another example, which is even more current, is nuclear energy. The U.S. used to have the biggest programs for training nuclear engineers, people who would design nuclear plants. There are almost no programs left in the country now. There are a few, one at Berkeley and one at MIT and one at Michigan, but very small. The production of nuclear engineers has gone almost to zero. In particular, many of the students now majoring in nuclear engineering and doing nuclear power plant design are not U.S. students. They're students from abroad who are coming to these few programs we have left. And they're going back to China or France or other places where nuclear power is still being deployed. And I think if you look at the challenge of moving away from fossil fuels, thinking of nuclear as a transition technology that you can use effectively without a climate change implications, with much lower climate change implications at least, is a completely rational thing. But unless we have the talent base, and unless we have the companies that know how to do it, we're not going to be able to do it.
So what happens to knowledge and education as universities stop teaching different research and engineering disciplines?
Presumably the knowledge doesn't go away. Whether it gets transmitted to a new generation, I think, becomes a key. It's also important, I think, to understand that every university doesn't have to try to do everything. We need to kind of play to our strengths and do the things we're good at and think of the U.S. higher education system as a group that works together to try to educate people in areas of demand. But it is the case that federal funding, as well as, for example, in the case of nuclear, there were no jobs left in the U.S. doing nuclear plant design because there were no nuclear plants being designed. What do we have? We had a 20, 30-year moratorium on nuclear plants, right? And now this one being designed in Georgia is the first one, and I don't remember the exact, but it's 20 or 30 years. So there were no jobs for people as well. Students aren't going to go to programs where there are no job opportunities. So I think that all needs to be balanced, and we need to look at it, and we need to think about it. And I think from the federal viewpoint, you know, with respect to federal policy and research, they have to take a long-term view. I mean, if you look at what happened in energy research, the number of energy research dollars plummeted. There was a peak during the energy crisis during Carter's years when gasoline spiked. There was an increase. Then there was a long, long decrease in federal investment in energy, which on an inflation basis only got back up to the levels that it was in Carter's presidency, in Bush's second term. That's how long it took to rebuild it. Now, imagine that we as a country had been investing in energy research during that whole time. Would we have made much greater progress than we've made today? Probably. We'd probably have better battery technologies. We'd probably have better solar cells. We'd probably have better alternative energy forms. And it would have been very wise to do that. But that's not what we did, for better or worse. We pulled the money away as the worst of the gasoline crisis went away. We pulled the money out of the energy research, and now we're getting back into it. But we've got to rebuild the entire research infrastructure. And you have to realize that from the time you begin to make the investment to the time when you not only have done the basic science, developed the technology, maybe spun it out, grew it into a company, and it began to have its effect, that can take 20 years. So we now have to rebuild this. We started in the second term of the Bush presidency. During Steve Chu's position as Secretary of Energy, that funding went way up. Now what we have to do is continue it. We have to continue it going forward so that we don't slide backwards again.
Thank you for joining us today on KZSU Stanford 90.1 FM. Today we are privileged to have as our guest Stanford's President John Hennessy. The focus of today's interview is to find out how Stanford University plans to deal with the federal budget cuts to scientific research. Do scientists at Stanford advertise for themselves as much as the professors who work at Stanford's business school?
Probably not. Scientists, to some extent, let their work speak for themselves. That's the way you're trained as a scientist. Humility is a good thing, and scientists think that way, and they think when they write a paper and they put the result in the paper and they've made a discovery, that it should speak for itself.
Does Stanford, MIT, and other leading American universities, do they advertise their scientific research accomplishments so that the public understands the value of what they're doing?
I think the difficulty with that is that the frontiers of science often involve very complex discoveries. It's very hard for ordinary people to understand and comprehend what's being discovered. And I think we need to think about how we raise that visibility. And I think sometimes you see this happen, and particularly around major awards, the Nobel Prize or other things. They really serve as an opportunity to remind people of the importance of long-term investment in science and discovery, as well as, of course, to create role models that will inspire young people to think about going into science. And sometimes it's just crystallized. When the two gentlemen won the Nobel Prize for discovering that bacteria was, in fact, the cause of ulcers, and they did it by actually doing the experiment on themselves, I think that was an amazing.
Those two scientists won the 2005 Nobel Prize for Physiology and Medicine. They are Dr. Barry Marshall from the University of Western Australia and Dr. Robin Warren from the Royal Perth Hospital.
That was very easy for people to understand. These guys, and not only that, but they drank the solution. They got the ulcer and they proved it, right? When Brian Kobilka won the Nobel Prize last year, explaining that to people, you know, so you explain these complicated surface proteins and signaling and things, but that wasn't the way to explain it. The way to explain it is, this is key to understanding why aspirin does what aspirin does. And so you can find very simple ways to tell people that, or why an antihistamine can block histamine, which can counter an allergic reaction. You need that kind of simple explanation for it, so people see that. And I think when you have that, then we can build that connection to people. The new Queen Elizabeth II Prize for Engineering is going to be given out later this month, and Vint Cerf is one of the awardees of this. And it's being given out to five people who made fundamental contributions to the growth of the internet. So that's something people easily understand. They understand how transformative the internet has been and the World Wide Web, and recognizing five people who were really pioneers in constructing both the internet and the web, people understand that. So we need more of those kinds of examples where we're talking to ordinary people and people can understand what happens.
Do you think Stanford students are aware of the importance of policymaking?
I think they are aware. I think they may not fully appreciate how complex the process is, unfortunately, how slowly it often moves, and how to get that policy shift to occur. And one of the most remarkable things I think about when you go to visit Washington, D.C. and talk to various people there, I mean, we have great senators and representatives, but the people that really make the work of Congress happen, as well as in the White House and other places, are a bunch of incredibly dedicated, highly idealistic young people who want to make the country better. And they work incredibly hard to try to make progress on these things. Lawmaking is a very long and complex process. And even sometimes, despite what would appear to be incredible support for things, we can't make a change. I mean, look what happened with recent gun control and just a law that would simply require that everybody who buys a handgun gets it registered. We couldn't get it to pass despite the fact that more than 90% of Americans support that. It shows you how difficult the process can be inside Washington. That's one of the valuable things of a program like Stanford and Washington. Students go and they see how the process really works. It's like that old joke of going to see a sausage factory, right? You see how it's made and you may not want to eat it. It's a little bit like that. And I think understanding that and understanding the diversity of opinions that are brought to Washington, I think, are important. And I think we'll see this with Mayor Bloomberg's speech at commencement. I mean, he's taken a number of positions, which I think if you asked our student body, whether it's a position on gay marriage or immigration reform or gun control, they would all be behind the mayor. Now, making it happen will be the real challenge.
Thank you for joining us today on Modern Tech News on KCSU Stanford 90.1 FM. Our guest today is Stanford's president, John Hennessy. The focus of the interview is to discuss how Stanford plans to deal with the federal budget cuts to its scientific research. In the next section, President Hennessy will give us a summary of Stanford's budget.
The total budget of the university, well, this year, our budget is somewhat over $4 billion. And that doesn't include the hospitals, but it includes everything else, Slack, the medical school, but not the hospitals. Hospitals are about another close to $3 billion by themselves, but overall university budget is just over $4 billion. It's about 25% research. It's about 22, 23% is endowment. Maybe 15 or 20% is gifts that support current research, so expendable gifts of various sorts. Then about 14, 15% is tuition. And the rest is all kinds of miscellaneous things. Clinical income from the hospitals that get paid to the medical school, all kinds of little pieces come into play.
So what kind of budget would make the Stanford researchers happy?
I think if we were getting inflation plus a little bit, not a lot, inflation plus epsilon, I sometimes say, I think that's a good model. We had a process, for example, where the NIH budget doubled between 99 and 2004. The NIH budget doubled. There were unintended negative consequences to that doubling because, of course, it doubled and then it actually fell at a very low rate for a long period of time. We would have been better off if it had gone up, maybe instead of doubling and then going down, if it had just gone up by a little faster than inflation, but for 20, 30 years. I think that's a better model for universities. It's more stable, it's more long-term, and I think probably would have been better to do. I think the difficulty is the federal government doesn't sign up for 20 or 30 year agreements to fund research like this because each Congress that comes in, it is their job to set the budget and they have the right to do it. So it's very hard to get them to agree to that kind of opportunity. The thing about the country's research investment is I think you can unequivocally prove that it was a good investment and it plays out in things like not only the U.S. leadership in science and technology, but it also plays out in terms of what's happened in economic growth in this country versus in other countries that haven't been as progressive in terms of funding research.
Why is it so difficult to make the case for the importance of scientific research and research on mitigating climate change in Washington and in other states around the country?
It's a very complicated situation. We've got parts of the country that don't believe in evolution as an explanation of how we've gotten to where we are, or that don't believe in human-induced climate change. I think they're hard problems, and we don't always do the best job of explaining them appropriately. We could do a better job as well within the academic community of talking about this. Part of the difficulty, for example, around climate change, is we're talking about risk. And Americans don't understand risk. If you ask the average American, 20 miles from your house, we're going to build either a coal-fired electricity generating plant or a nuclear-based. And you ask the average American, which they have to choose one or the other, they can't say none of the above, which would they pick? I'll bet you a lot of them will pick that coal-burning plant. And I'll bet you, if you look at the data, most of them did the wrong thing for their health and their community by doing that, because they'll have a high pollutant, and it's not even a climate change issue, it's simply the pollution coming out of, in terms of particulate matter and other things from a coal-burning plant, and of course, moving all that coal in and out. The nice thing about nuclear is you don't have to move very much fuel. So it's a risk element, partly. They just don't understand the risk element aspect of it. So we're not good at explaining this, and we're not good at explaining to people, and I think that's the problem with climate change. Can I tell you precisely what the climate rise will be, precisely how many additional hurricanes you'll get, how strong they might be, what the sea level change might be or in coastal areas? I can't tell you exactly. I can give you some kind of probabilistic distribution that says something about it. And I can tell you that there are big parts of that distribution that are going to require that you fundamentally change how you live in coastal regions, for example, or in inner regions in the country where temperatures could soar up to a number of degrees hotter than they are traditionally. Now the question is, and again, it's this point we were talking about at the beginning, this isn't a problem to be solved for today or tomorrow. It's a problem to be solved for 30, 40, 50 years. It's a problem to be solved for our children and our grandchildren. That's the perspective we need. It's the same issue we have around reforming healthcare. We can survive for the next 10 years with these healthcare costs going up the way they can. We can't survive for 30 years with it going like this. Getting Americans to make that long-term understanding and leap, and realizing that if we begin to change our climate future now, then the impact will be greatly reduced. If we wait 30 years and we have Katrina-scale hurricanes every single year, and then we say, change it, it's not going to happen. It'll take a very long time to restabilize and renormalize, because once you've put all that CO2 in the atmosphere, the only way to bring back a climate that you had earlier is to get that CO2 out. And the problem is the cost of extracting CO2 from the atmosphere is much higher than the cost of not putting it there in the first place.
In the last 2 minutes of this interview, I asked President Hennessy if he had any good news for Stanford's researchers.
The good news is that I think we will, you know, as an institution, we will continue not only to try to influence and make our point of view understood in Washington, we also will aggressively seek other ways to find funds to support research. We can't replace that entire federal investment. But I think our friends and our alumni understand the power of research, what it's done to change lives, improve lives, keep the U.S. in leadership position. And I think they will help us support it. And that will help us dampen, not completely remove the effects of the federal government reducing its research, but maybe dampen the effects slightly. And if we can do that, and we can turn this curve at the federal funding agencies so that, and I think what we first have to do is keep it from going down every year and then get it flat and then kind of bring it up a little bit every year. If we can move in that model, I think we can minimize the impact to the research community.
The last thing in today's interview was President John Hennessy's advice to this year's graduating class.
I hope they've had four remarkable years here. I think they now go out with a Stanford degree and with a mind that hopefully has been enhanced in its ability to learn and has learned a tremendous amount of things. I hope they do great things with it. I hope they go out and change the world, make it better, and whatever profession, whatever career they go into, they make it better. And I hope they come back frequently and visit this terrific place.
You've been listening to Modern Tech News on KZSU Stanford 90.1 FM. Thank you for joining us today for our interview with Stanford's President John Hennessy. We would also like to thank President Hennessy very much for his time and for this interview. If you would like a copy of this interview, please download it from our website, moderntechnews.com. That's moderntechnews.com.